We were in LA.
Nice.
With Dr. Dre and Exhibit. We'd met Carl Kanai. We'd interviewed Wu-Tang. MTV had paid for one episode. They got four for the price of one. They promoted us to executive producers. And as we got on the plane back, me and my boy were like, we smashed it. Year one in the bag. Bring on year two. First bit of news we got when we came back is we're fired.
What?
Yeah.
Happen podcast with Matt Callanan.
I'm Matt Callanan. I'm a former international DJ and music producer turned podcaster, filmmaker and founder of the kindness project We Make Good Happen. Like your life transformed with new opportunities? Would you like the same status as a book author? Would you like increased sales for you and your business? I've achieved all of this by doing this exact podcast. Now I'm training people exactly like you in a super easy style how to launch a successful podcast. Just go to podcastlikeapro.co.uk. That's podcastlikeapro.co.uk.
Thank you, thank you, thank you.
Hello and welcome to We Make Success Happen. Today, with amazing human, Alain Fusion Clapham. Hey,
that's a great intro. Thank you. Good to see you, man.
Lovely to meet you. So you've been, I think, a number of things. There's probably going to be a few things I miss out here.
Sure.
Musician, yeah. Journalist, teacher, TV presenter, storyteller.
Event manager, radio host for a little bit, minicab controller.
Let's
not
really?
Miss that out. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and a short stint pointing at a recycling machine.
Yeah,
and
okay.
Telling people how to work it.
Was that the highlight?
That was definitely on the showreel of moments in my life. But I mean, jokes aside, that actually was a defining moment in my life, and I was like, okay, this is where things either go really, really, really bad, or things pick up. Yeah, so I value all those moments.
So what, you used it as leverage then?
You had to. I mean, like, the gig was literally the invention of the recycling machine in car parks. So there was a sign that said, you can put plastic in it, you can put cardboard in it, and you can put glass. And I had to stand there as people came by their vehicles, finished shopping in Tesco's, and go, see this thing here? You can put plastic in it. Just literally stuff that was written on it.
Yeah.
It was just so new. And, you know, everything had fallen apart at that moment in my career. And I just refused to go to the job center. I just thought I'd much rather work for less money and be out there in the world than sitting on my ass.
What was the stigma about the job center then?
Okay. It was more a case
of... Because I think we've offended half the audience, all two listeners.
Good. Good. Listen on. The story continues. If you fall on hard times... It's there for you. It's one of the great things about the state. If you reach for the stars and you fell over and grazed your knees, you were reaching for something. Keep going, reach for it. So I have no aversion to people drawing on that. And I contributed a lot of money over the years working for different companies. But, you know, I wasn't done yet. I was properly wounded as far as like trying to be somebody and things falling apart. But I needed that. Yeah, I needed that fire. I needed to be out there doing something. You know, one of my bad habits when I was a lot younger was timekeeping for sure. Mm-hmm. And this job required me to be there at 8 a.m. in Cheshunt, just outside of London, to park up in a car park and stand by a machine to keep the machine company.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that your kind of like life job goal then when it was younger?
Yeah. One day I'll befriend a machine that will save the planet. Yeah. It sounds like Terminator.
Well, out of those jobs then, or those kind of roles, what's been your most favourite?
Things are just getting better and better in my life. And I stopped kind of measuring what the best is. When I was a teacher, I would tell my students, if the world ended now and everything froze and someone said, you know, what are you doing? I'd be like, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. I'm supposed to be in this room. And the students always were impressed by that answer because some of them didn't want to be in the room.
Yeah.
And they needed a teacher who believed in the moment and what they were teaching. They knew I'd interviewed all these celebrities. They knew I'd had videos on TV. They knew I'd had success, but they didn't know that I cared as much about what I was doing. So that was like, I thought, yeah, that's it. That's what I love the most. But moving into being a transformative storyteller and being able to travel around the world and meet different audiences and tell them stories of where I've been, and those stories connecting with people, and then that evolving into opportunities like this, meeting new people and telling more stories, I'm like, this could be the best thing ever. So yeah, it's between those two. When I was much younger and I was a journalist, it was just this crazy ride. I didn't have a handle on the controls. It was just like, you were on a roller coaster. One minute you're a journalist writing for a small newspaper. Next minute it's a dot-com boom. Next minute, you know, you've been offered a TV show. Next minute you're negotiating a 45 grand contract for a year and you're still wearing a baseball hat and shorts. I was just like, this is great. But when it fell apart, I didn't know how to put it back together again.
Because you've interviewed people like Jay-Z, Dr. Dre, Stan Lee, Beyonce, Ed Sheeran, Jennifer Lopez. It's a really good lineup of people, isn't
it? Yeah. I mean, I picked all the winners.
I mean, all down to you.
Some of it was. I'm going to take the claim to fame where it was relevant. My friend says you have to live your life, you know, going forward, but you can only understand it by looking back. And one of the things that I prided myself on being a journalist for a small paper, we weren't heavy hitters. If there was a celebrity of the day, we had to get right to the back of the queue. So if it's Mariah Carey or someone who's already platinum, you could get an interview, but it was like you weren't high in the pecking order.
You had one question.
yeah. But somebody like, say, Jay-Z at the time, he literally hadn't released an album yet. He was a guy with a single and I just bought it for £10. And there was a thing called Jay-Z's Listening Party. On the other side of it were little snippets of the forthcoming album. And I was so blown away by the snippets. I took the record back to the office where I worked and I called the number on the record. That was it. And somebody picked up, it could have been Dame Dash for all I knew. And I said, I want to interview Jay-Z. And they like, where you calling from? I said, from London. Hold the line. Literally 2 minutes later. Call back on Wednesday this time. And nice. I knew those 2 minutes, they were going, oh my days, there's a guy on the other side of the world who wants to interview you. We're hot right now. So I got the first exclusive interview with Jay-Z in the UK.
Nice.
So he was just like any other artist hustling to get somewhere. Retrospectively, it's a great story because he went on to become iconic artist. But I just had a hunch he was good, you know.
So I saw you do an amazing talk this morning at the Creative Mornings event.
Zoop, zoop. Big up to the great guys, man.
Big up to Melin, who hooked up this connection and made this podcast happen. So yeah, big kudos to her. And in this talk, you talked about how you originally wanted to be an artist when you were a young boy.
I was an artist. No one could tell me different. Like looking back, I was doing oil painting on canvas, seven. And it wasn't like I had a picture in front of me that I was copying. I just was like, okay, I just want to draw a meadow. Cool. I draw a fence. I draw a tree. I draw a lighthouse. Put an ocean there. Blue sky. It was just intuitive. And now as I look back and I see children, there's just this innate ability, some awesomeness they have. And if you can find it early, it's such a gift. And painting was the thing that shaped me, the quiet kid. I love the idea of just imagining things and making them real. Yeah.
Did you want to talk about why you kind of used the sort of painting? You kind of mentioned it this morning about your dad. I don't know if you want to talk
I'm good with that. There was, thankfully, not so much now, stigmas around mental health. When I was growing up in the community I come from, you know, my mum is from the Philippines. My dad is from the Caribbean, an island called St. Vincent. And within the black culture that I was very much part of, nobody talked about mental health. If something was wrong in the family, it was the family secret. And if somebody was completely unreachable, they were sent away. And my mum was a phenomenal woman and she had tremendous resilience and love. So she kept that man well. But I talk to her now and I look back. Now I'm at an age where I can appreciate who she was at the time, like I've surpassed the age that she was. And I just thought, wow, you've got two children and your husband's just gone back to the Caribbean to help his mum build a house. And he's just left behind a four-year-old and a five-year-old. And he's missing them, but he's going back to do the work for his mum. And when he comes back, while he's there, he becomes ill. And then people have to go out there to get him back home. And when he comes back home, he's never the same again. Mm. And I can only just imagine what it would be like to have someone who you love waving goodbye to them at the airport and they never come back the same. They called it manic depression then. It's called bipolar now. And he wrestled with that for his entire life. And she was the support mechanism to get him when he was low, to pick him up when he was becoming manic, to help him recognize the signs, and quite often fighting the system to get him in so he could get help. And then he was on medication for the rest of his life. So when I matched that against this really quiet kid who painted a lot, I just realized, I think in a way I was creating worlds that I could control amid all the chaos that I couldn't, because it was normal. It was the only family I knew, but I knew from other families it wasn't normal.
So what did you kind of like delve into first, career-wise then?
So from seven, just painting and drawing and creating and then making things happen. And I went all the way to A-level, and then I went to art college. And when I went to art college, I remember enrolling and then going to the first class. And in our year group at Middlesex University, it was a small campus called Cat Hill, and there were about 138 students. I was the only person of color on the whole campus.
And the whole campus?
The whole campus. Like, it was an art campus. So yeah. I just like, when I left, black left, there was nobody of color on the campus. So when I turned up, I was always rocking, I was from Tottenham, so I was always wearing whatever we wore.
Yeah.
But I was just this modern marvel, like these baggy corduroy trousers you have, it's incredible. And the way you wear that and this top, and I was just like, where I'm from, this is real regular, you know? And I just started to feel like a tropical fish in the wrong tank. I just could not swim through that water. It was weirding me out. And art is really, you have to connect with yourself. And I just started to feel really odd.
What, did you feel like an outsider or something then?
No, I was.
Yeah.
I was an outsider. Everything that they were into, I didn't get. My reference points didn't make sense to them. And you can assimilate a bit. You end up at the student union, drinking a couple of pints, you know, listening to indie music or whatever was the thing that they were listening to. Yeah, there was some joy in that. But there were things which were going on in my mind. I think by the time I was 18, 19, being black was something which was being projected onto me. My mom's from the Philippines and my dad, he's from his background, but there wasn't a racial issue within my house. There's a real harmony. And even when I was a child, when I went to the Philippines, meet my grandparents for the first time, they were just like, yeah, that's our first grandchildren. We love them, me and my sister. So my experience of being black was the music, and it was the police. Being stopped, I remember running at 14, I got to the bus stop and then forgot something. So you're only 14, you just, everywhere, you run everywhere because super fit and that's what you do. And I'm running back to my house to go and get something, and then the police stopped me and they're like, where are you going? I'm like, I'm just going home. And then it dawns on you that, well, you're black and you're running. So that's what's interesting to them. By 18 or by 17, my friend, it was his 18th birthday and we were all trying to go uptown, you know, be big lads, go to try and get into the cool club. And we got to the bus stop and then it all went downhill. A police car pulls up, ask us some questions. Another car pulls up, a van pulls up. We're like, they must be trying to get some crazy people out here.
Yeah.
We were the crazy people they were getting. They decided we looked like the right people. And we ended up spending a night in a cell. And my friend, I remember him giving his details and the police were like, that's mad. It's your birthday today. We're like, yeah, amazing, isn't it? Yeah, we did a robbery on his birthday, just to mark the occasion.
God.
So getting out the cell at 4 a.m, being innocent, having to have called a lawyer for the first time in my life to represent me, even though I knew I'd done nothing, was beginning to shape me. I was getting angry.
Yeah.
And you couple that with what was going on at home in terms of managing that reality as well. I really was struggling at art college and the rage came out in the art. The art got very political.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
You know, what were the paintings like then?
Well, they weren't even paintings anymore. They were photocopies and pastiches and conspiracy theory collages and stuff. And I was like, yeah, this is my truth. And they're probably thinking, he's on a list now. This guy is, you know, he's really kind of expressing some intense feelings. But I bowed out after that. I got offered a place.
yeah,
for a full degree, and I was like, I can't do this. And that was the end of the art adventure and where music began. I put all of that rage into hip-hop because at the time Public Enemy was the group. Big Daddy Kane was the rapper. NWA were telling you what you could do in terms of like your frustrations and with the police. You could tell them, get away from me, get off me.
Mm.
And I put those headphones on in my bedroom and I was like, this makes sense. And I was like, I want to make music. I want to DJ and yeah, be part of this movement. And I've never stopped being part of hip hop, and it's been one of the most positive definitions of my cultural heritage possible. Yeah.
So did you end up getting a record deal, didn't you? Or a nice deal?
It was the dream. Everyone was locally good. You had local kids who could rap and we cut and scratch and whatever. But the dream was always to cut a record. Literally, you know, when you went to, you know, back in the day, it was Tower Records or HMV.
Mm.
You go in the racks and there'll be records there. Or you go to specialist record shops. And the dream was to have a 12-inch record with your face on it, with your name on it, is your song. And it was hard back then. You couldn't burn a CD. It wasn't anything like that. So when I made songs and people didn't care or laughed, I kept going. And then one day I hit upon a formula, took a bit of Northern Soul. Worked with this good friend of mine now, Spider J, and we put a bit of reggae seasoning on it. Garage was the thing, so the beat was double time, skipping, and we made a song called The Groundbreaker. And no one could put it in a box, they tried. And we just, you know, my friend said, hey, this, my friend was like, he knew Skinny Man, he knew all the cool like artists, and he said, your song, this demo is in my top 5 UK hip hop rap songs of all time.
Wow.
I was like, you're crazy, but okay.
Yeah.
And he took us to all the record labels, Def Jam, Raucous, all the ones that really were like top flight. And they all started a bidding war.
Nice. How old were you at this point then?
I would have been probably about, 24. Yeah, 24. And I've been doing it since I was like 17, 18, just being tenacious. But that's why I became a journalist, because I couldn't make a living rapping or producing, but I knew a lot about the culture. So I was good at writing. I finally liberated myself from the journalism and launched into a music career. I remember jumping on the train with a check in my hand for, you know, one half of a record deal.
Who did you sign with that in the end?
So it signed with Raucous in the end. You know, that was like the incredible indie label. It had like Mos Def was there, Talib Kweli was there, and they just signed Called You Rap. And I was like, wow, we're on the roster, first UK act. And things didn't work out, just politics, but eventually the song came out like a year and a half later on Virgin. And it was there in the record shops. I bought a copy of myself. Yeah. You know, I went to the shop and bought my own record.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I just couldn't believe it was actually in the shop.
I think because I used to put records out myself. I never had my face on a record, but actually there was something really going into a record store and seeing your own record there.
Yeah.
You feel really proud.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I bought my own record though. I don't think I stooped that low. But to see other people buying it, or, you know, actually just seeing it there was immense, because you realize the amount of production and talent and time and effort and staying up late or getting up early that goes into
making
that record.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was crazy because like it was chart bound. It was a record which, if you knew that week that enough people jumped on it, it could be in the charts. And the charts always back in the day, it was the top 40.
Mm.
I bought my record, but we got in at number 41.
Oh.
It was a moment we just watching the charts like, oh, so close. So close.
Because were you listening when they did the chart countdown, or do you find out before whether it's got to like 41 or something?
There was like pre-information. You might hear midweeks.
Yeah.
We just call it the midweek, you know, where your song was moving up or down, it was fluctuating.
So it's a really close call though.
Yeah, my life is full of those. Yeah. Also ran moments. So you're like, okay, not quite. But the dream was to make a record. It wasn't to be in the charts. And we were on playlists. I remember hearing my song in clubs and John Peel played it, you know, stuff like that. It was like, actually, it's got to be more in the end of the day.
Yeah.
You know, it was one of those weird records, like on the punk show on Radio 1, they played it.
Yeah, okay.
They thought, this works. And then people like Brazilian music play the instrumental because it had a certain syncopated rhythm. I was like, this song actually fits so many different walks of life. So I never looked back.
What should people search for? We'll link to it in the show notes.
Yeah, Groundbreaker. It's called The Groundbreaker, Fallacy Infusion. And I'm proud of it. I still stand by it. Sounds good.
So that was a kind of tick box for you in the music. Yeah.
Huge, yeah. If I died, I would have said, you know what? I did the damn thing. It was the dream at the time. It's weird when your dreams come true because then you need new ones.
So you were doing TV presenting and stuff like that as well. But you mentioned at some point it kind of came crashing down.
Oh, yeah.
What's all happened? Didn't you say the TV show kind of ended and...
Yeah. You just realize you're just kind of, you know, you are like, got this micro macro thing going on in life. You just like, you are the center of your universe, but you're not the center of the universe. Like, you're just a little cog in this bigger machine. And I laughed in the talk because I was saying we were terrible at the beginning. We had no TV training.
Yeah, okay.
We're just fresh from the world of journalism and photography. And they were like, you guys are cool. You seem to like hip hop. Have a TV show. I was like, you're drunk. We're here in Ireland, drinking Guinness. Probably. But I mean, it was such an innocent time. Digital just launched. So they were like, you fit the bill. So when we did the first episode, I couldn't even look at the camera. I was so shy. And it was
a TV presenter that can't look at the camera.
Yeah, that was me. Yeah. Not my fault. I didn't ask for the damn show. They gave it to me and I took it. So I remember saying, what was the feedback? And, you know, they were like, don't worry about that. Just keep going. Yeah. But
by show two, had you started looking at the camera?
I gave it a go. Yeah. I looked a little. And then, you know, like we joked off mic earlier about one of your previous podcasts about the mum test. Like, don't.
The lovely Neil Cocker.
Yeah. Big up Neil. Dope podcast. And it's like, don't run your ideas by your mum because she'll always co-sign you. She'll always say how awesome you are. You have not met my mum. Mum is the realest G out here.
Yeah.
She will be like, yeah, but you talk too fast. I've been watching a thing like, yeah, okay, I'll try and talk slower. Then she'll be like, look at the camera. She'll be giving you all these pointers because her thing when she was in the Philippines when she was young, she was into drama.
Yeah.
And she's super creative. So I'm like, okay. So she would really watch the show and be like my ride or die, just giving me feedback. But there was one episode where I was like, I'm not getting better. I'm going to quit. It'd be better for the whole world that I leave, someone else takes this show and does the damn thing. But a friend of mine listened and he was just like, I see what you're doing. It needs work, but I believe in you.
Mm.
And then that meant something. Next episode, he called me up and said, it got better. And that was it for me. I was like, okay, I'm going to get better. That's all I'm going to do. A better effort every time. And unfortunately, he passed away probably halfway through.
Mm.
But by that time, we had so much mastery of our show.
Yeah.
We'd excelled to such a degree, we were able to dedicate the whole show to him. And to be able to go to your producer and say, you don't know this guy, but he is why we are good at what we do. And that episode touched people because people always saw hip hop as dance, gangster, money, cars, girls, but it's so much more. And we did an episode about life. There's a song called They Reminisce Over You by Pete Rock and CL Smooth. And it's a homage to Trouble T. Roy, who's another hip hop who died. And we made that as a tribute to my friend Mark ESP. People from all over the country wrote in. And that's how we knew the show mattered. Yeah, we were crap at the start. But by the end, we were freaking awesome. We were in LA.
Nice.
With Dr. Dre and Exhibit. We'd met Carl Kanai. We'd interviewed Wu-Tang. MTV had paid for one episode. They got four for the price of one.
Nice.
They promoted us to executive producers. And as we got on the plane back, me and my boy were like, we've smashed it. Year one in the bag. Bring on year two. First bit of news we got when we came back is we're fired.
What?
Yeah. Change of management. And we weren't the look they wanted.
Wow.
Yeah. That's why when you heard the story about me being in the car park recycling stuff, it was just like I'd done nothing wrong.
Mm.
Everything I'd done was the fullest of my ability, but it wasn't enough. And that's the thing you have to, in the talk I was explaining, is these fires come into your life.
Mm.
Sometimes they rage and they destroy everything and there's no rationale. But if you can understand that sometimes it saves you from something. And I found the music industry to be incredibly toxic. The media industry, incredibly toxic. And I lost my living, but I kept my integrity. I'm still here. So I'm grateful that things didn't work out, but at the time it was a real kicker. and hard to deal with.
Yeah, so how did you kind of get out of those? I guess it was quite a dark moment then in your life.
Oh, yeah. A lot of people don't recover. A lot of people, and I understand that. You're catapulted into cultural relevance. Now the playing field's more level because people have Instagram, YouTube. If you want to push yourself, you can push from the place you stand. You're in your house, you're in your, you know, studio hookup, and you can reach the world. Back in like 2000, you needed someone to co-sign your signal.
Yeah.
So you look back, say Walkman Wise back in the day, or Bruce Forsyth, or these were entertainers when there were free channels. So millions of people had a shared experience of an individual.
Massive audience.
Massive audience. Yeah. And we mean like domestically, everyone in the country knew you. Mm. So this wasn't that, but we were known. And then they turn off the signal. You can't broadcast. So you're dead. People like, you're the guy who used to be on TV. You're a used to be person.
Yeah, because you've got no control. Whereas now people have got a lot more control.
100%. Yeah. In fact, it's almost more powerful. If you get kicked off that and then you go onto one of the social media platforms, your audience was already there and they'll continue following you. My friend ended up working in HMV and it was the craziest thing. He was a guy who was telling you what was hot and now he's in the shop giving you the CDs from the shelf that you're buying. Mm. And people in the shop couldn't handle it. Like, you're the guy from the TV and now you're giving me a CD I'm buying.
Yeah.
And I was like, I was always somebody who had a plan A, a plan B and a plan C, and they were all good plans. They were all good plans. Yeah. Like,
so that's even, a good idea, I like that.
Even when I was on TV, I didn't really buy it. I was like, one day a week, it's not the biggest check. And I'm on a website and I'm getting paid good. And the internet back then wasn't like the big deal it is now, but it was well invested. It had the dot-com boom, but there was millions of pounds in it. So I was cutting good money being on this internet thing. And with that good money, I was like, I got half a day off. Because I tell the dot-com company that I had to film MTV for a whole day, but I only need to film for half a day. So the half a day I had free, I took myself to the studio. And I made all the records I always wanted to make. So when the whole thing exploded and went wrong, out of the ashes emerged this music career where I had all these songs. And what was laughable, they kicked us off MTV. The show was canceled. And within about 4 months, I was back on MTV with my music video.
Nice.
Yeah.
You were like, yes.
Oh, yeah. That was like, yeah, another tick box moment. Yeah. I'm like, you know, it was great to be interviewed by the guy who fired me.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And just to be like, hi, sorry, I'm back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what was that kind of experience like?
Great. If you know the art of war, brilliant lessons. I learn that whoever controls the media controls the edit. Mm. Whoever controls the edit controls reality. So I can be like, Matt, you know, like if it's my show, Matt, I think you're such an incredible guy, so talented, such a pleasure. And you'd be like, oh, this guy likes me. They'll ask you some tough questions. Mm. Then in the edit, I take out all the niceties and leave the tough questions. And that's what he did. He took out all the I admire you crap.
Oh, really?
And edit it down to just the bare basics. And I was like, okay, I'll remember that lesson.
Yeah.
So I went from being a novice to having, you take your lumps, you know, and then you become adept. You start to learn how the media game's played. And that's always been my journey, just to kind of reclaim the power and use it for progress and to help. Was always been the underdog to me, the young people, the independent artists, the audience.
You mentioned there that you had like a good plan A, plan B, plan C, plan D or whatever.
Yeah.
Is that part of like good preparation, or do you think things are eventually not going to work out and you kind of almost expect things to fail or blow up or end or change?
It's interesting how things pan out. I call myself fusion. What's a fusion? A fusion's an amalgamation of many things. So I've never been able to sit in one square. There's a guy called Imhotep, who is considered to be the first mason, the first builder of great things.
Hmm.
Built the Step Pyramid. You know, as far as like Architecture Weekly, I mean, that's a great job, you know? Still standing like 4,000 years plus. So he was considered a polymath. And when I was like, polymath, that sounds great. What is that?
Yeah, what is that?
You know, he was like the man when it came to construction, but also the man when it came to building, and the man when it came to medicine, and the man when it came to this, all the different like disciplines he was a master of. And for me, I was like, what would it be like if you could be a journalist and you could do radio and you could make music? Why limit yourself? The fallacy was a rapper. He made me laugh. There was one thing he said in an interview. He said, I don't want to be pigeonholed because the only thing you find in pigeonholes is pigeon shit. And I was like, yeah, okay, cool. I don't want to be pigeonholed, definitely. I'm so grateful for any expression or talent that I might have because I know there's loads of things I can't do. Mm. So I would always just try lots of different things.
Because what there are a few people that will say, just concentrate on one thing.
It's probably because they can just do one thing themselves. So it's good advice. If you can only do one thing, great. Mm. You know, if you're a frog and you can go in water and you can go on land, don't tell that to a fish. You know, the fish is like, this is my gig. Mm. I do the water thing. So for me, I'd always look at who's giving me advice. When I got into teaching, I was so determined not to bring the blues with me. The I failed and now I'm here. I was like, you know, what is it that I learned? What can I protect people from? And what can I learn from this next generation? So, you know, I always try and look at the temperament of the person who's giving me advice as well. And they don't always know. Some people are wounded. Some people lack insight into certain things and they have the best intention in the world. But not all advice is good advice.
What's the best advice you've been given then?
Be careful what you ask for because it just might happen. The guy was a photographer. He's very successful now. And he was shooting me for a project I was doing. And he just asked me and I said, I just want to make a million by the time I'm this certain age. And he said, be careful what you ask for. It just might happen. And what was crazy was I was on my way. I was earning way above what was expected for someone that age. But I was way miserable. I forgot to add that into the dream.
Yeah, be happy.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So you kind of evolve the idea of what your dream is. I just wanted to be successful. Coming from, not struggle. I mean, my parents did okay, but we weren't sitting on legacy. We didn't have like a property that was in our name from a previous generation. They were working their way up from rent to owning to move into a nicer neighborhood. So we were all on our way up and I was on... let's go to the next level. So I was like, wow, yeah, everything you ask for, you get. So you have to be really clear about what you're prepared to lose and why you want what you want. Mm. You know, and sometimes it's okay just to be just grateful. Like today, I was just grateful, man, just to give the talk. And then I'm on Insta. My partner's laughing at me. She's like, oh, you're on Insta now a lot. Yeah. Like, you know, like I've always been like, oh, I don't have time for that. But the outpouring of people being so connected and positive and good feedback. I'm like, just do your very best and see what comes of that. And that's how this podcast happened. So I'm with it.
Yeah. Gratitude is very powerful.
Yeah.
My wife's really, really big believer and she sort of does it every single day. And I try and remember to do it every day. I always try and do it when I'm going for a run, sort of, you know, grateful for this, grateful for my son, grateful for this work, you know, grateful for this. And it's just nice to sort of put that out into the universe.
Do you mouth it when you're running? You're like, the headphones.
That would look like, a bit like shout it out. I'm grateful.
Thank you for the sunshine.
I do go running at 6 a.m. I just wake up everyone.
Yeah, yeah, they'll know you're coming.
What is it about the power of story? Because you're really big into storytelling.
Oh, yeah. It's just the best tool. You know, you are a story. Your name's a story. Even before you have agency over your story, you're someone else's story. How my mum met my dad is such a hilarious story. And if you can understand those stories and release from them some value, it can liberate you. You know, I know some people, they're trapped in stories. They have an idea that something's happened to them and it defines them now. And you try and liberate them from that and tell them how it could have happened to anyone or it's over now, but they're still living in that narrative. Mm. And other times people, you know, I know people who've had cancer and whatever they thought their narrative was before is just obliterated. And all of a sudden they have this new lease of life and they're fearless because the new story is they've had a second chance at life. So I don't believe you have to have extreme experiences to re-examine past experiences. I think this ability to reflect, refine is the same as creating something as it is creating a reality that suits you. You know, when I wake up in the morning, the thing I try to do is think of 7 things I should be grateful for before I get out of bed. Sometimes I fall back asleep again.
I'm grateful for more sleep.
Yeah. But it's kind of ended up in these self-help books and quite woolly crap, really. But if you strip it back, you know, that power to speak into people meaning is incredibly important. You know, when I go out, I've witnessed when I went into the youth sector working with young people, there's something quite liberating about not knowing who they are. You go into an auditorium or a hall and you're filled with an intention to connect, to offer value, to find a way of making people feel their humanity. And then you give them a mic and you watch the teachers. And at the end of the session, they go, she never says anything. She never says anything. But she came all the way from the back and she grabbed the mic. She talked to all 100 people. And then I'm like, well, I don't even know who she is. You know, I don't know, but I know who we are. We're people who are dying to say something. Mm. We're people who want to feel valued. And if you create that frequency, then you can lift people out of this, I don't matter, or I'm scared, or I'm nervous. And then they start to tune in. So I'm always keenly look to help organizations, individuals, friends. And I always keep an eye on the story I tell myself about who I am as well.
What would you say to those sort of people that are locked into their own internal story that might be negative and is actually holding them back through where they were brought up or fear or something negative? How do you kind of get out of that internal story that might be holding them back?
I wanted to say this at the talk. Mental health is so important, and there are so many different agencies involved in maintaining people's general well-being and mental health. One of them is friends, being able to talk to a friend about how you authentically feel, because that friend, if it's a good friend, won't judge you. Having services, you know, provided by NHS or provided by organizations that specifically train with the Samaritans to help people when they're really in a difficult space. But if all of those bases are covered, the question I ask people, or sometimes want to ask people, is who told you that story? It's not your story. You have to love yourself. Because when your conscious mind, your conscious state goes to bed, what wakes you up in the morning? It's not you. Your body is still breathing. Blood is still coursing through your veins. Your heart is still beating. Your whole being is designed to celebrate and to live. So what part of you is failing to understand that? Quite often there's stories that have been told to people. You're no good.
Yeah.
You let me down. You always fail. And that becomes like Pavlov's dog. You know, this thing of the bell rings and the dog eats. And after a while, just the bell makes the dog salivate. And sometimes people become addicted to these stories. These sounds define what they believe is true. You just never know when that happened to them. Some of the things that shaped me happened before I was 7. And there's a guy called Bruce Lipton, who's like a really fantastic scientist, doctor. He studies epigenetics. He was saying that up until from like the third trimester to the age of 7, you're like a hard disk recorder. And any information put into you is filed. After 7, your mindset changes. And then what happens is you process information differently. So you take a girl who's 3 or 4 and you just speak Turkish to her and a bit of Russian. She won't go, well, I don't know if I really want to learn Russian today. She'll pick it up. Try that with someone who's 12, 13. Immensely and immeasurably more difficult. So some of the damage is done by parenting that could have been better. That sense of not being loved. And it's phenomenally difficult to unearth that behavior because it's locked in the hard drive. So all of these things come to mind when I think about why people don't have enough love for themselves or why they tell themselves negative stories. But one thing I say is a negative story about yourself is like a negative prayer. It's kind of seeing yourself as not worthy. Whereas a positive story about yourself is a positive prayer. You're saying, these are the things I want for myself.
How do you get the courage to make things happen?
Ask yourself what would happen if you didn't do it. We take time for granted. It's the most precious commodity. You know, you have somebody who's a millionaire who has one day left to live and ask him or her what they would do. They would probably give away most of their fortune for another week, another moment. But while we're living, we're like, oh, it's life thing, time thing. I can do it whenever. And for me, it's just like, you have to really be just conscious of time. My boy Wisdom, another great name, it's a hip hop, isn't it? But Wisdom talks about opportunity training, and he describes it as a revolving door. Like, yes, you can do it now. Oh, you missed it. Okay, just wait. It'll come round again. Oh, you missed it. Wait. Some people watch that door go round and round and round.
Yeah.
You know, there's always an excuse. Yeah. I'm too young. You know, I'm not ready for that. And it's like, well, I'm ready for it, but you know, I haven't got enough money. And it's like, I got the money, but I got to spend it on the mortgage. Oh, okay. Then I got to put the kids through school. And then there's, oh, now I'm too old. It's like, how many more excuses?
And now I'm dead.
Yeah. Yeah. For real. And it's just like, okay, you know, they say the best time to plant the seed for a tree is 20 years ago. And the next best time is now. So I've had the courage in love, in life, in music, in creativity, once in a while just to just say, go for it, just do it. You do fall on your face sometimes, but that's because you had to. There was a lesson in that. So pick yourself up, learn quickly, and give it another go.
Yeah, because I think I heard someone say that the biggest group of ideas and dreams are in the graveyard.
Yeah. It might have been Steve Jobs.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah. That's where they die. And there's just really interesting theories about idea generation. People die, but their ideas, they're kind of the whispers, half-finished manuscripts and ideas said to somebody. You never forget a good idea. If someone tells you something interesting or good, you pretty much log it. So they're out there in the ether somewhere. So, yeah, have the courage to just pull yours down and do it. It's terrifying, but it's exhilarating. If I have no purpose, I... pretty quiet and chilled guy, be at home cooking, relaxing. But as soon as it's time to step up, yeah, game time, let's go. And I'm always terrified when I go out on stage.
Are you?
Oh, yeah. Always. Because it's real. Who cares how good you were last time? When I was Wormwood Scrubs and...
I can imagine a little bit of fear kicking in there.
That was crazy. It was like...
So life. This was in front of prisoners and...
Yeah, it was like a definitely up there, like visceral, powerful moments of my life. It was crazy because I was hosting the event, but I was one of the curators for the event. So with myself and a lady by the name of Sherry Davies went into the prison on behalf of Sirius and we met inmates. And we were told we had the freedom to work with them to create songs. And they didn't all have musical experience. They didn't all know each other. And this is Wormwood Scrubs. It's a serious thing, you know? And I'm going there thinking, do I go in there like snarly, like, you know, like, yeah, you see, you know, like really like man up and tough. Or do I just go in there and say, hi, I'm here to be part of something. And they told me, they showed me what to be. And they came into the chapel and they looked free. They were smiling. One guy walked in, Sherry was playing the piano. One guy started singing straight away, soulful. And I was like, these guys recognize opportunity. Whatever stereotype people told me about prison, for these guys, they smashed every stereotype. They were deeply reflective human beings ready for change. So back to the gig, were the lessons we taught them good enough to perform on stage before a Grammy award winning artist? We've only had a few hours with them. Will their inmates mock them for even wanting to be something other than an inmate? Will the public who've come in understand, or will that public be paranoid that they're literally within arm's reach of convicts of whatever description? No one knew what they'd done. And I remember hosting, I thought, if I'm really serious, it's going to set the tone for really serious. If I'm going to create a safe space, I'm going to have some fun. And I remember I wrote one joke. I don't often write the jokes. I just say what it is. But I said, this is the only gig where half the audience couldn't wait to get in.
I like it.
And the other half,
yeah,
can't wait to get out. And before I even finished it, they were all roaring with laughter.
That's brilliant.
And it just broke the ice in the room.
Yeah.
But by the time my guys finished, Rhiannon Giddens was almost in tears. And I was just like, of course I should be scared because it matters. When you meet someone you love or you feel for and you want to ask them out or tell them how you feel, it's terrifying because no is as real as yes. But to not know at all is nonsense, to miss the moment. And I'm like, of course I'm hosting this gig because some other guy steps in with some, hey, everyone, and ruins it. I'm accountable for that. So I took the gig to curate it and to host it. And my mum was in the audience, my sister, and these men who had trusted us with the musical integrity. So I think terror, fear has its place on the journey to success. You can't navigate around it. There's no B road to get there. You have to go through it. It's part of your rite of passage. And I think it's always going to be there. It's just like, if it isn't, I think something, I know I'll fail. If I go on stage, if I went on at the Creative Mornings and I didn't feel a sense of, here we go again, I'd have failed. I'd have been too cool for school. Mm. But yeah, I love people. I love people, man. I don't understand them all the time, but I love the fact that someone has the agency to take themselves somewhere and believe something good will happen. And I want to be part of the good thing that happens.
What do you want your legacy to be then?
I'm done with that. I'm done. I've closed so many chapters and I've got so many more to open. I'm just like, pick a page, man. It almost, this is for me.
That could be on your tombstone, isn't it? Pick a page.
Pick a page, yeah. Several tombstones. Yeah. It's just like, yeah, interacting with swipe on it. Yeah. I'll make a note of that. I don't know. It's just for me. It just feels a little bit grandiose that I should even think, why should people should remember me? You know, I've been to enough funerals. The story is hilarious. You never know what someone's going to say about somebody. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad, but you know, everyone has their own right to remember something. Whatever the legacy is, I'd like it to be true. Mm. If there's something about me, I'd like it to be something which I would have been proud of. But I think at this point, you know, all the different life chapters, being a kid and having a gift and not quite knowing how to unwrap it, having a job for your first time and going all the way with something. And then where I'm at now, which is just like, I don't know what's going to happen next, but it's going to be the best. And I like that.
What does success mean to you?
I'm going to be remembered as the guy who just kept on saying affirmations for the whole of your thing. Ben Sweetland has the quote for me. He said, success is a journey, not a destination. And so if I'm in my flow, I know what I hate, like food, you know, sometimes like, ugh, celery. Celery sucks. Like you can chop it up and you can marinate it, but that just means you're hiding it because it sucks.
I'd put it in a smoothie, but I wouldn't.
Yeah, you wouldn't.
Pick it up as a snack.
Nah. That's what I mean. It's people, I know we've upset maybe one of the two people listening.
Yeah, yeah.
Like somebody loves celery out there, but I know why I hate sitting in an office doing the same thing like an automaton. I can't do it.
Mm.
My mind always iterates and comes with new ways of doing stuff, and that frustrates some people. Yeah, I always gravitate towards like exciting, innovative things. So I'm just like, success is, let's just go on a journey. I don't want to do the same thing again and again. Mm. I want to go do something, ace it, move on to the next thing, do something, fail, learn from it, try again.
Mm.
You know, so just be on the journey. I always said, you know, if I was in charge of, you know, Cancer UK, like my first CEO meeting, like, right, we're going to have to end cancer this year and you're all going to have to get another job.
Mm.
That's what we're working towards. Like, you know, I think there's my boy Yoshi is a great mentality. He's a Chinese medicine doctor. And he said, in the East, the traditional Chinese medicine doctor was paid as long as you were well. So the family doctor would be paid all the time. If you were ill, you stop paying him.
I like it.
Yeah. And I was like, wow. So he's just watching you all the time. You could, he's coming straight over, mixing some herb and fixing you. We live in a society where it's like, we pay people because things break. Mm. We wonder why things break.
Yeah.
Because if that's how people make a living, because things are going wrong.
Mm.
I love the idea of getting
paid. It's the wrong way around.
It's completely upside down. It's like, I love the idea of getting paid because everything is going A-okay. So yeah, that for me is success. Just making a positive change and enjoying your role in it.
Okay, so last question then. Imagine all your friends and family are on a lovely beach and you've hired one of those small little planes that carries the message behind. These are your kind of final words of wisdom that you can leave all your loved ones and your friends with. what would be on that message on the plane?
I think it would say, help Matt's trying to kill me. But if it wasn't that, it was your evil genius plan to bump me off in style.
Yeah, we're not going to finish you here after straight after this. Right, let's book that plane.
Well, at least my family get a holiday out of it, so I'm not mad at that. Yeah.
It's a theoretical question.
Okay, cool. Yeah, legal disclaimer. I have the answer. That's the easiest question of today. Yeah. It's what I always say, which is forward is the motion, the path is negotiable. Stop doubting yourself, man. Just go for it. You might have to climb high, dig deep, go around, blow it up with dynamite, walk through it. But there is a path for you forward. Find it.
Amazing words. Elaine Clapham, Fusion. Thank you very much. Much appreciated.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Subscribe, rate, and review the We Make Success Happen podcast.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, I would really appreciate you leaving us a great review up on iTunes or your Apple Podcast app. It means a lot. Thank you very much. I've been Matt Callanan, and I'll see you on the next episode.
This is the We Make Success Happen podcast with Matt Callanan.